Welcome to Novel Agents and Emerging Strategies in the Management of Metastatic Colorectal Cancer, an audio-video CME program. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. John Marshall, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
So this is a 70-year-old lady, your classic, nice patient, smart, educated, gets that she has metastatic colon cancer and that we're not going to fix her, and we're going to treat her and extend survival. And so she gets initial chemotherapy. In my shop, we tend to use a lot of oxaliplatin up front. We use a lot of capecitabine, just the ease of administration with the pills versus the pump. And frankly, we figured out some dosing there that makes it nice and simple. And we use bevacizumab. We usually go about 4 months. We try not to get to 6 months, quite honestly, because almost everybody gets some unpredictable neuropathy about in that space. And so we back them down to quote-unquote maintenance. And the maintenance strategy that we're using in a lot of our patients is capecitabine, more or less continuously dosed. You know, the breast docs are doing week on, week off. We were using two on, one off. But really, the study that was done called the CAIRO-3 study used a continuously dosed capecitabine, a lower dose given pretty much every day. We give weekends off. I figure if radiation doesn't work on the weekends, neither does chemotherapy. And so we go 5 days on, 2 days off, usually a gram BID. We have a little trick there that we like where if they're zero hand-foot syndrome at a gram BID, we then go to their MCV, and those hematologists in the gang will know that if you've got enough fluoropyrimidine on board, your MCV will go up because of the antifolate effect. So sort of the perfect thing is a patient with mild hand-foot syndrome and an MCV somewhere around 105, 110, you're there. You've got enough capecitabine going. And then we give the Bev Q 3 weeks as sort of our standard maintenance at 7.5 per kilo. Now, in this patient, you know, you do that for a while, and we forget that 5-FU and Bev are really pretty good drugs, and they work pretty well. And as is typical in a lot of these little old ladies, really, they respond well for a long time with this kind of recipe. And so this lady goes a year before minor progression. And the question always is, okay, now what do you do? Do you go back to your ox? Do you change over to your Erie? And that's the fundamental decision point. It's even further complicated in those patients who are EGFR RAS wild type.
Just a couple of questions. Where exactly was the disease located? And what specifically happened in terms of progression? Did she have new lesions or growth of old ones?
So this lady has a couple of lung lesions, but she also has liver and some abdominal adenopathy. So not large volume, any of it, but in a location or locations that we're basically not going to go to surgery with this lady. We're not going to do a lot of different metastatectomies in this patient. And, you know, she has a nice response, and the progression in her case is relatively minor. You know, millimeter increases in nodules, CEA going from 5 to 10, but she's still asymptomatic. So, you know, it's not like she's got disease blowing through and is symptomatic from her cancer. It's minor progression.
And she had a prior history of colon cancer?
Well, she had had metastatic disease right from the get-go.
So what did you do about the primary? Where was the primary?
It's a sigmoid lesion, and frankly, she was pretty asymptomatic from it, so we sat tight and just watched it. So she indeed had the primaries in place, too.
Did you either re-image or re-scope her to see what was going on with the primary?
So, you know, what to do with primaries in these patients is really up in the air right now. There's some literature out there, retrospective stuff, that says taking it out is a good idea. You kind of want it out of the way so you don't have to deal with it downstream. But on the other hand, you have to pause all your treatment to do the primary resection, and you have to hold drug for before and after, et cetera. So just as you kind of suggested, yeah, we often will repeat scope these folks. And in her case, actually, she has a nice response. And so on a colonoscopic exam, you don't even see her primary anymore. And that's not uncommon when we treat these folks. Now, that's not to say she's got no cancer there, but endoscopically, she's okay. So we don't really fuss with her in this case.
Now, did she have symptoms from her primary bleeding or obstruction initially? How was this picked up?
Yeah, so just like with everybody, she has some minor symptoms. In her case, though, she was just due for her colonoscopy. She had asymptomatic metastatic disease. And of course, this is that dutiful patient who's going in to get their screening. And, you know, we talk a lot about when should an older person stop getting screening. And here's a lady, you know, at 60, 65, gets a colonoscopy crystal clean, is now 70. She might even be having a discussion with her primary care about, do I or don't I even bother with colonoscopy? And we got to remember that most 70-year-olds nowadays are really very fit and would be expected to live another 10 or 15 years easy. So I would argue in favor of continued screening, just as this woman picked up her colon cancer.
You know, it's funny. I just flashed on the fact that the very first person I ever interviewed in colon cancer was you. It was like, I can't even remember how long ago.
A long time.
I was thinking of all the people since that first interview that I've interviewed, nobody, including you, I think, has ever mentioned this thing about the MCV, which really makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
How long have you been doing it? And do other people know about it and do it?
Well, I get picked on a lot when I talk about it, but the literature is full of this relationship of chronic fluoropyrimidine and causing the folate deficiency, causing the elevation in MCV. And we just sort of lit on it as we were doing a lot of maintenance and not sure what dose to give. And we were noticing that a lot of folks were coming in with MCVs 105, 110. And of course, we were checking B12s and folates and all of that. And we weren't finding anything. And then I go down the hall to a really smart heme guy, Craig Kessler, down the hall from me. And Craig's like, stupid, that's the 5-FU doing it. And so we actually published some literature on this and using it as a biomarker for patients.
Yeah, it's really cool. It makes a lot of sense. Incidentally, my audio guy who was actually there for the first interview just IM'd me saying the interview we did was in 2001. That's a long time ago.
Yeah, some hotel room somewhere.
Yeah, right. It was a hotel room somewhere. So anyhow, this lady gets to a point that a lot of people do. She gets some kind of Oxali, Bev regimen, Capox, Folfox, responds, and then has asymptomatic progression. What were the options that you think you would consider in this situation, and which one did you go with?
So I think a lady like this has a few choices. One is it's slow progression. It's taken a while. You know, do you tweak your doses of the capecitabine a little bit? You know, there's an occasional patient, I'll even push the Bev up to the higher dose just to see if I can get a little more mileage. Or do I accept some minor progression for a while based on the quality of life that she's getting? Versus a patient who's a little more anxious, wants to get treatment. And in that case, you've got really two choices. You could go back with your ox, or you could change over to an Erie-based second line. And really, most of the time, I will switch over to Erie. Unless somebody really says they don't want to lose their hair or some other issue, I'll save that ox. Now, I'm going to replay that card. It's still a card in my hand, but I'd rather play it downstream a bit and switch over to irinotecan. And then the second choice you have is in patients who are RAS wild type, do you want to switch your biologic? I do not. I tend, particularly in a patient like this who's clearly benefited from frontline VEGF therapy, I'm going to keep VEGF therapy going into second line and save my EGFR for later lines of therapy.
And her tumor was RAS wild type?
Yes, she's got a RAS wild type, one of the now 40%.
So the other issue is which biologic? And theoretically, there are three, you know, at least anti-angiogenics, and just putting aside EGFR, aflibercept, obviously continuing a Bev, but also now ramucirumab. Can you kind of compare the data that we have for those three agents and then talk about what you did with her?
Yeah, they all three essentially have the same basic clinical trial design. The Bev was a Bev beyond progression, so that's a little different. But the other two clearly came in with second line with FOLFIRI, and they both show about the same amount of improvement in overall survival and progression-free survival of a relatively short amount of time, you know, 1.5 to 2 months. Bev has really pretty good side effect profile, and of course, most of the patients you have at this point are already on the Bev, so you know you can give it. The aflibercept to me is a little spicy, and frankly, my experience is limited to one dose, one patient, a few years ago when it first came out, and I really haven't used it again because of its toxicity profile and, frankly, to some degree, its cost. Ramucirumab I haven't yet used in colorectal cancer. I've used in gastric cancer. So it's a nice drug. It's easy to use. It has a little higher side effect profile. But I never thought I would be telling you this, Neil, but it turns out Bev's the bargain of the three. And a very interesting analysis was done by smart people that said, you know what, even though they're all expensive, for the biologics, Bev is the least expensive of the bunch and a value relative to some of the others. So frankly, for me, I'm sticking with Bev.
And in fact, you know, we've done our surveys both of investigators as well as general oncologists, and most common choice in this situation is FOLFIRI, continue the Bev. What happened with this lady?
So we actually added back in a little irinotecan. I'm also one of the quirky ones who will keep capecitabine going with irinotecan. You have to, again, be smarter with your dosing because you can get more diarrhea trouble and the like. So we kept all we did was add in irinotecan. And she did have some minor regression, and she's currently on that now.
Any tolerability issues with the irinotecan?
Not too bad. Now, a lot of folks will, you know, should we be testing UGT1A1? Should we be dosing? You know, when you use an every 2-week dose of irinotecan, the UGT1A1 doesn't really come into play much. And a 70-year-old or older, I might drop the dose to the 150 instead of the 180. I would not fault anybody for doing that. In her case, we gave her full dose and she did okay. But, you know, every 2 week, I don't check UGT1A1 routinely in patients, watch them close through the first few cycles. But, you know, it's interesting. If you've got somebody who's tolerating irinotecan, they can take it forever. They really do very well long term. So it's a drug that I'm hoping for her can stay on board for a while.
So thinking about future treatment for this lady, I'm curious, and I wouldn't have asked you this question a couple of months ago before the ASCO meeting, but are you going to test her tumor for HER2 and for MSI?
So we're really engaged in this. So we're doing everybody for MSI and actually have been for quite some time because, you know, it's still a valid poor man's test for HNPCC and Lynch syndrome, et cetera. But now, of course, you've got some clinical evidence around, really strong evidence around the therapeutic impact of a checkpoint inhibitor in this subset of patients. Now, it's only 4% of the total, but you got to look and you'll find them. HER2, absolutely. Now, we're engaged in a sort of national collaboration with some other cancer centers where we're doing a lot of prospective profiling because, you know, we have a lot of these trials. They're the rare tumors, as you suggest, the MSI, the HER2s, and there'll be others. You know, RAF, if you look at BRAF mutations, there's now some evidence around combination therapy working there. So all of a sudden, you're starting to pick off little wedges of the pie where you'd want to steer a patient in one direction or the other. So almost all of our patients at this point with metastatic disease are getting prospective profiling for exactly those reasons.
Could you comment a little bit on the data that was presented at ASCO? There was one study looking at lapatinib trastuzumab, a non-chemotherapy regimen that's been used a lot in breast cancer. And of course, as you mentioned, with the MSI-high patients, pembrolizumab. Can you talk about those data and whether it would prompt you to use either one or attempt to use either one of those strategies right now outside a trial setting?
Yeah, the answer to that is yeah, if I can get a hold of the drug. I mean, it's fascinating. This ASCO was really setting a tone that the phase 3 randomized study is becoming an endangered species because what's the hot topic is the right profile, the right drug, and dramatic benefit. And at least for the checkpoint inhibitors, we indeed did see that dramatic benefit. So Dung Lee down the street, down 95 or up 95 from where I'm sitting now at Hopkins with a nice collaboration, did a really well done clinical trial of testing the lore, right? We all thought maybe MSI high was a more immunogenic tumor. So there wasn't really a lot of preclinical or data to support that. They said, let's just do it. And so they collected MSI-high colons and MSI-high others and normal colons, if you will, traditional colons, and put them all on checkpoint inhibitor. And in fact, if you had an MSI-high tumor, the waterfall plots will knock you off, you know, from back of the room. Lots of responders, long-term responders, and very well tolerated. So this was, you know, really moment changing. We all have open studies now to all we're going to have to do is repeat that data. We're not going to have a randomized clinical trial for this because the drugs are on the market. And if you can show prospectively that this genetic profile predicts for a very positive clinical outcome, we're done. Those drugs will be approved very quickly for that subset. The HER2 side of things, EGFR HER2 side of things, I think a little less clear. Now, I've been around long enough to have remembered when trastuzumab first came out, they had the twinkle in the eye of let's look in every cancer that has any HER2 positivity and try this. And we were involved in the clinical trial back when I had hair a long time ago. And, you know, we couldn't find HER2 positive colon cancer. And so they gave up. And that's got to be 15 plus years ago. And so all of a sudden, now that more profiling is being done, better testing, better quality tissue, all of that, sort of revisited it, right? And what they found with this combination is significant, not through the roof, not, you know, trastuzumab and breast cancer kind of numbers, but significant clinical benefit in those patients, and it's under 10%, but it's a significant piece of the pie of patients who were HER2 positive. And so the answer is yes, we're testing everybody with metastatic colon again as part of a broader panel, but HER2 being an important part based on that, both for clinical trials, but also, you know, there's this new initiative from ASCO, the TAPER study, and there are others out there where, you know, if we could show the profile, get access to the drug, the payer will be happy because the company's going to give me the drug. But in exchange, I'm going to give the information back to the company on what happened in the hopes that we can change indication so that we can actually get formal approval for payment in those subsets of patients.
So, you know, the basket approach to oncology that we've been looking for so long. In terms of MSI high, you mentioned that other tumors have this. Which other tumors?
So you can get it, anybody with the Lynch syndrome, there are a bunch of other tumors. There's GYN tumors, gastric, and others. I mean, you know, we did profiling the other day. I sent a patient with a cholangiocarcinoma for broad profile. The guy had no family history for cancer and the like, and I get back a BRCA2 mutation.
Wow.
Right? So, you know, the more we look, the more we're going to find, and that's why I'm really excited about these new initiatives around broad profiling. We are in kind of an awkward adolescence with profiling because for right now, some insurance companies are covering that, others are not. Some of it is research. So who should be funding that? And so there's an anxiety for a doc out in the world to say, I don't want my patient to have a $3,000 bill because I sent profiling if it's not going to really help that patient's outcomes. And so what we're trying to do quickly is demonstrate that there's cost effectiveness in doing profiling. You know, I order Chem-20s all the time, not expecting to find hypercalcemia, but every now and then I find hypercalcemia, right? So, you know, should we just, instead of a la carte gene ordering, should we start to do more broad testing?
So, you know, as you mentioned, the data with the MSI high looked, I mean, it actually looked even better than, you know, lung cancer. You know, it was kind of melanoma looking. Thinking, for example, about this lady, if you knew she was MSI or if you had known at diagnosis, would you, if you could have access it, give it first line?
So there's a study going on just getting initiated of looking at half getting chemo and half getting single agent checkpoint inhibitor in that subpopulation. I'd go on that study if I was a patient with MSI high colon cancer. So yeah, we want to do that. And we'll see it move earlier and earlier.
Yeah, I kind of wonder whether it's going to evolve into sort of a renal or even melanoma paradigm where they go for the immunotherapy first. If the patient's asymptomatic, they don't have, you know, disease that's immediately threatening, hoping to launch them into a long response. Do you see that kind of algorithm coming to colon cancer?
Yeah, maybe, I think. But remember, this is a 4% subgroup right now. So what we really got to figure out around immunotherapy is, okay, we've been working, you know, I've been working for 20 years of my life on trying to stimulate immune responses, so to create those T cells. Checkpoint inhibitors work when the T cells already exist, and all you're doing is cutting the brakes, if you will. So now we're trying to broaden that 4% to a group that would benefit by using combinations of immunotherapy vaccine plus checkpoint, et cetera. So now I think in the end, just like there's some patients for EGFR therapies and some patients for angiogenesis therapies, there's going to be some patients for immunotherapy. And will we be able to convert them to immunoresponsive? That's still to be seen.
So let's move on now and talk a little bit about later stage metastatic disease. And I think we can get into that by hearing about your 54-year-old man.
Yeah. So this is a guy who, you know, more and more we're seeing, these are patients with small volume cancer. They've had all their treatment. They're working full time. They feel good. And we get them through Ox. We get them through Erie. We've used some biologics, but they're still fine. They can still walk into my office carrying their x-rays and going to work and raising kids. And, you know, what we've been doing, and this is a lesson I've been learning lately, is we've been recycling. We've been trying a different VEGF inhibitor or this and the other. But, you know, now we have a couple of new medicines. We have regorafenib and we have TAS-102. And these two medicines, single agent, stabilize in about 50%, 40, 50% of patients, and about a quarter of them will be stable at 6 months. So this is not inconsequential therapy. And I think we as oncologists have sort of written these medicines off because they don't have a big response rate. Well, neither does recycling oxaliplatin or irinotecan. And the more we've looked at regorafenib, we recognize that in the smaller volume disease and the earlier better performance status, actually the curves get better than that 1.4 months. So there's some more recent studies that actually show that in that patient population, you're getting more bang for your buck. So for me and this guy, small volume disease, used everything, I'm going to try a course of regorafenib first before I recycle. I got more proof. I got OS benefit on the table that I don't want to leave. And I think part of what we did before is we used these drugs as pre-hospice. And if you wait, they're not going to be well enough to tolerate or to play out the benefit from those treatments. So that's what we did with this guy.
Now, at the time you started treatment, what was his condition? What was his performance status? Where was the tumor? And was he having symptoms from the tumor?
Good. No, not really any symptoms. The guy was walking in feeling pretty good. You know, he's a typical young, small volume metastatic colon patient that doesn't have surgery options. This is your classic phase one patient. This is a patient we're now sometimes going back and doing new biopsies to look for molecular profile, to try and pick trials, this kind of thing. You know, it's an aside, but the more we've been doing this, the more we've been doing serial biopsies and profiling on patients, because in colon we get a lot of tissue from them, the more we're recognizing that we don't know what we're doing. So we've got patients where one tumor is RAS wild type, the other is mutated, and the like. So, you know, one biopsy, one profile, in my opinion, is not enough in metastatic colon. And just like the breast gang is rebiopsying around HER2, I really encourage folks to get more and more tissue and do these profiles.
Yeah, lung cancer too. And now they're talking about serologic assays for mutations in lung cancer. Yeah. They're really exciting.
Going to be new. Good.
How did you approach dosing in this man? And how do you approach dosing in general with regorafenib?
So I'm kind of stuck on this where I still tend to start people at 160. I think the other half of the gang is starting at 120, and some are even starting as low as 80. What's nice is that there are some very focused clinical trials trying to answer this question of, can I start lower and still get my clinical benefit? So regardless, whatever you start at, watch them weekly. You can't start them and see them in 4 weeks. You got to watch them weekly. You got to watch their hands. You got to assess for fatigue and dial that dose up and down, because almost all of the significant side effects occur within that first cycle. And if you can kind of coach him through that, it works okay. Now, this guy is interesting because he started at 160 and hated me 2 weeks later. It really had a hard time with it.
Hand foot.
He's a runner. He's active. He had to stop. He said he'd keep doing it if he had to. And I'm like, no, no. So we dropped him to 120. After a few days off, and he felt much better at 120. He got second cycle at 120. His CEA fell, his scan's stable, right? So he's feeling good, actually. And so what did we do? We pushed his dose back up to 160. And interestingly, he actually, for that next cycle, didn't have that rough time. But the following one, he did. So, you know, we're dialing up and down right now. Until we have fairly clear evidence that 120s is active, I think that's what I'm doing.
And what's his current situation?
He's recently progressed. So he was on about 6 months. So he's in that 20, 25% of patients who will be stable. Nice fall in his CEA, minor regression. We talk about no PRs with this drug, but you do see minor improvement. And it's been these kinds of experiences that have moved this drug off of pre-hospice for me as a real card to play for patients with metastatic colon.
Now, what are you thinking about next for him? Would you use TAS-102?
So we actually have access on the extended use program. So he's deciding between TAS-102 and a clinical trial. He's working full time. He's busy. And so for him, TAS-102 would be very simple. And he had a good experience with the regorafenib. So he's game. He's going to get access to it. And so that's his next step.
How do you think you're going to sequence it in terms of with regorafenib?
I think with both drugs, you've got dose and schedule problems that we need to work out. What I think will happen, quite honestly, is that TAS is going to move earlier and be used in combinations with chemotherapy. And I think regorafenib, at least for right now, may not. There are some maintenance studies going on with regorafenib and some other approaches. So as dosing and data come forward, I think what we'll see is that they'll sort of evolve and not be head-to-head in competition for very long.
So I want to do sort of a John Marshall Journal Club and go through some of the papers that you've been involved with. And one that caught my attention was rechallenging 5-FU in a patient with capecitabine-induced ventricular fibrillation. That sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, it was exciting. So this guy, nice guy, 50-year-old again, writes constitutions for a living, for goodness sakes. And he's got bad metastatic colon cancer, and he's responding. But every week on this Monday through Friday capecitabine thing, he says, you know, he's running, his jaw hurts. He's got a little shortness of breath, and his jaw hurts. And I'm like, oh, God. So, you know, of course, we do EKGs, nothing, everything's fine. So I say, okay, on capecitabine, and we're going to do a treadmill test. And so while he's on the treadmill, he goes into VFib and dies, okay? So the cardiologists get him back and, you know, put a defibrillator in him, and he's fine. And so
he has metastatic disease, right?
Yeah, metastatic disease, and a lot of it, too. And so I'm like, am I never going to give this guy fluoropyrimidine again? And the data, if we remember, the cardiac stuff with fluoropyrimidine is with chronic exposure. So we rechallenge him with good old-fashioned bolus 5-FU, and he never had another problem. Again, of course, I could be a little more confident because the guy has a defibrillator in him now.
Wow.
And he had a year more of bolus 5-FU. He's downstream on treatment now, and actually we're going to rechallenge him with some fluoropyrimidine. We were talking, actually, he's very smart. And he came back and said, do you think the TAS-102 will do this cardiac thing? Because it's also chronic,
I was
right?
thinking the same thing.
And I'm like, I'm nervous about retrying it. I said, well, because his defibrillator did go off once by accident, so he knows what it feels like. I said, do you want to risk that? Or, and he's like, well, no, we'll pass for now.
Wow. But,
anyway, good case. And so we wrote that up. It's a well-known thing. It's a great board question. Lots of times that board question gets asked. Chest pain in a patient on FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, or capecitabine. You want to think cardiac. And remember, your coronaries can be clean. It's a vasospasm. And in some cases, like this guy, it's an arrhythmia.
Do other drugs do that?
I mean, not to my knowledge. I mean, you get your old anthracycline stuff. There's a long list of cardiac toxicity drugs. But for this mechanism, no, I think it's a fluoropyrimidine-based thing.
Fascinating. So you also had a paper, the Journal of Oncology Pharmaceutical Practices, not a journal I typically read, but I thought that—
You don't read that?
No, I don't catch that one, but I thought that it was very interesting because, you know, there's a lot of questions about using bevacizumab in all types of older patients, not just with GI cancers. And this one was utilization in U.S. elderly patients with colorectal cancer getting Bev.
So, you know, it's the beauty of working in a strong cancer center is that I have folks who are thinking about this side of the business of, you know, epidemiology, utilization, cost, rationale for that. So I'm just the clinical brains behind this paper, which, you know, really took the SEER database and looked at older versus younger and actually showed that we're very inconsistent about how we utilize bevacizumab. And we bring to the table a lot of biases about this, older patients, stroke, heart attack, worry, bleeding, clotting, those kinds of things. And so I understand that, and we have to remember that Bev is not some miraculous medicine that's going to cure metastatic colon cancer. So I think using good judgment and picking your moments when you use the drug is still prudent, but it just showed in that paper that we're not really very consistent.
What was seen there, though, in terms of toxicity? Because that's been the big question, as you mentioned. Even otherwise healthy older patients, we know that particularly general oncologists, tend to pull back on using Bev around age 75. And I haven't really been clear whether the data supports that in terms of complications, assuming, again, they don't have other comorbidities.
Yeah, so we look at admission rates. You look at, from SEER databases, you can figure out whether there were higher rates or their ICD-9 codes, soon to be 10, that people had cardiac issues or other things on top of it. And you don't really see a great explosion in that older age group. So what I do in my practice based on that is really take a good history around cardiac, around stroke, and then, you know, use the drug if it's in the right patient at the right time.
So a couple other papers that you weren't involved with, but I'm curious what your thoughts were. The first, again, from ASCO. I'm always curious about these things looking at diet and exercise and, you know, supplements, particularly in metastatic disease. And there was some data actually from the 80405, the famous plenary colon paper that Alan Van Dook presented. But now this is looking at vitamin D status in metastatic disease. Can you talk about what they saw there and what you thought it meant?
Well, it adds to the literature that vitamin D correlates with outcome in colon cancer. Now, there's a lot of data in the adjuvant setting, so patients with earlier stage disease and monitoring this. This was really the first major study in metastatic disease suggesting that, you know, vitamin D may help. You know, it's funny, what's a normal vitamin D level, right? We don't even know that. And if you looked at the data, if you measured someone's vitamin D and it was winter, it was lower than if it's summer because of the solar impact on that. But they tried to control for all of that. I mean, is a high vitamin D level just somebody who's out running more and sort of more fit or not? And they tried their best to control for all of that variability. And despite that, showed this trend that the higher vitamin D level and the highest quintiles did better in terms of overall survival. And so we're translating this more back to the adjuvant patient where we are in clinic every day now, emphasizing to our patients the role of exercise, taking an aspirin, and vitamin D. And, you know, I haven't gotten into, and I know some docs have, tracking vitamin D, so actually measuring levels. And I'm just basically telling people, take some. And I don't think there's any harm in this. And we've had cases, and we've discussed these among ourselves, of patients who, you know, you don't really want to give them chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting. And we're saying, okay, give them exercise, aspirin, and vitamin D. It's empowering for the patient. We've got some clinical evidence that it shows benefit. If I had shown the same thing, that same curves for a drug, we'd be giving it, right? And so because this is vitamin D, we don't believe it as much, this kind of thing. So, you know, I think we got to embrace it and take it on.
I next met with Dr. Eric Van Cutsem, and to begin, he commented on a paper he co-authored that will soon be published as the second International ESMO Clinical Practice Guidelines of Metastatic Colorectal Cancer, and he commented on one of the most important recommendations, specifically about tissue testing.
We discussed markers and marker biology, where we made clear statements that all patients with metastatic disease should undergo marker testing, including RAS, including BRAF testing, and that there is also an emerging role for MSI testing for patients with metastatic disease, that this should be done at the diagnosis of metastatic colorectal cancer, not later in the disease course. We discussed also some of the other molecular markers, including NGS. There was a consensus that at the moment, other molecular markers, apart from the ones I mentioned, RAS, BRAF, and MSI, in metastatic colorectal cancer, don't have clinical implications right now. In RAS wild-type patients, as well as in RAS mutant patients, the most frequently recommended option is clearly a cytotoxic doublet plus bevacizumab. In patients where the goal is to convert the disease to become resectable, there the treatment strategy may be different according to the molecular pattern. In patients with RAS wild-type tumor, the majority voted for, based on the evidence of course, voted for cytotoxic doublet plus an anti-GFR antibody, cetuximab or panitumab. In patients with a RAS mutant tumor, where the goal is to convert them to become resectable, there are two options. In very fit patients who are willing to undergo a more heavy intensive chemotherapy, a triplet, FOLFOXIRI plus bevacizumab may be the option. if patients are a bit less willing to undergo more heavy chemotherapy, cytotoxic doublet plus bevacizumab may be the treatment option. And that's the RAS wild type, RAS mutant patients. And then the third group are the patients with a BRAF mutation, where there are two recommendations. Either go for a triplet plus bevacizumab, either try to bring the patients forward for one of the newer treatment options in clinical trials, being a combination of an anti-EGFR antibody, a MEK inhibitor, plus a BRAF inhibitor. So that's the global algorithm. And there are some clear changes in this ESMO consensus paper that will come up in the near future.
Can you talk a little bit about what we know about the prognostic implication of BRAF? From a therapeutic point of view, what are situations where it might change what you do? And what about anti-BRAF therapy?
Well, this is a very important topic for patients, and there is a lot of new knowledge on that. First of all, we know that of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer, around 6 to 8% of patients with metastatic disease have a BRAF mutation. There is evidence from many different trials that BRAF mutation has a bad prognostic role, regardless of the treatment. So patients with a BRAF mutant metastatic colorectal cancer, they do very bad. If you look at the different clinical studies, the BRAF mutant cohort, regardless of the treatment, their prognosis is bad. So it's really a bad prognostic factor.
What about in the adjuvant setting?
In the adjuvant setting, it's different. That's not so clearly shown. We have been looking at that in the PETAC-3 study, the older study with 5-FU versus FOLFIRI. We have looking at the prognostic role, and that's not so clear. But especially for metastatic disease, that's clearly established. Once these patients have metastasis, they do very bad, and their outcome is very bad in this situation. The second aspect that is important is, and that is new, is although the evidence from large trials is very low, there are some data from the Italian group around Alfredo Falcone that tell us that BRAF mutant patients, if they are treated with a triplet FOLFOXIRI, eventually with bevacizumab in combination, that their outcome improves a little bit. It's not as good yet compared to the other patients, to a patient with a BRAF wild-type tumor. But it seems that for these patients, and that's based on relatively low evidence, it's not based on the randomized data sets, low number of patients, but it seems that their outcome becomes a bit better when treated with FOLFOXIRI BEV. So that's the second aspect. The third aspect that is important also on BRAF for the clinicians is that the evidence is growing that BRAF mutant tumors, that they probably are unlikely to benefit from an anti-EGFR antibody, especially in later lines. We know that KRAS and RAS mutant tumors, they do not benefit, of course, from anti-EGFR antibody, but also the BRAF mutant patients, especially in later lines. If they have any benefit, the benefit is very little and very modest. So in our practice, if we have other treatment options for patients with a BRAF mutant tumor, we don't treat them with an anti-EGFR antibody. It's not completely black and white. There are some BRAF mutant patients who have a limited benefit to an anti-EGFR antibody, but the benefit is very limited and is much lower than in patients with a BRAF wild-type tumor.
Now, are these generally V600E mutations as seen in melanoma, or is there a spectrum of BRAF mutations?
Most of these are indeed the same mutations as in melanoma, V600E mutations. There are a couple other mutations also described, of which the prognostic significance is not so clearly established. They are rare. Only 6 to 8% of patients with colon cancer have a BRAF mutation, and of these, the majority are V600 mutations. And then there was another implication also for a BRAF mutation is that we have now, with the combination of the newer targeted agents that are being used in melanoma, that we see that in some of these patients we can induce responses. It is not clear what is the best treatment, but it is clear that it should be combination treatment, including different combinations, including an anti-EGFR antibody, cetuximab or panitumab, plus a BRAF inhibitor, plus a MEK inhibitor. That's possibly the best combination, this triplet combination. So targeting the pathway on different levels, EGFR, BRAF, and MEK. There are also some data, and they're all from phase 2 studies, that combining with an anti-EGFR antibody plus a BRAF plus a PI3 kinase inhibitor, adding on a different pathway, that blocking it, this also may lead to responses. The responses, however, are clearly lower than what we see in BRAF mutant melanoma. There we speak of 60% responses or even higher with combination of dabrafenib and trametinib, for instance, without the anti-GVAR antibody. In colon cancer, we speak of interesting response rates of around 30%, but then including also an EGFR antibody. It's not clear why in colon cancer with the same mutation, the same V600E mutation, why we see in colon cancer lower response rates than in melanoma. But the facts are there in different phase 2 studies are there that the response rate is lower than in the same mutation in melanoma.
Have responses been observed with these combinations that, you know, are clinically useful or, you know, clearly better than what you would see, for example, with an EGFR antibody alone?
Yes, yeah, clearly. With an EGFR antibody alone in BRAF mutant patients, we see hardly any activity. Activity is very limited, if there is any activity. And yeah, there is a clear difference in that response rate up to 30%. With the anti-GVAR antibody alone in a BRAF mutant tumor, if you combine everything, it's going to be less than 5% compared to 30% with the combination. We need a bit more data to see how long the responses are maintained. I have a couple of patients also, and I have a patient who was really in very bad condition, and she's now almost since 2 years on the triple combination with an anti-GVAR antibody, dabrafenib and trametinib. So it's quite some long time on treatment. A dramatic clinical improvement. It's a lady of 55 years old who was in sub-obstruction, poor condition, a performance, ECOG performance status of 2. Put her on the trial. She could swallow in the beginning the tablets, which was not easy for her. And now she's back part-time to work. She works at the university here and she's back part-time to work. So there are some patients with durable responses also. But we need, of course, to do some more work. But these are clearly treatment options that do work. We have to figure out a little bit. There are some safety issues. The skin toxicity is clearly there for patients with the skin rash with the EGFR antibody. The MEK inhibitors can give also some rash. But it seems that the combination, for different reasons, they don't add up to the skin toxicity. It seems that it's a bit less than what we see with the anti-GVAR antibody alone, but clearly there is some toxicity, some fatigue, some diarrhea in some patients. We reported these data at ASCO and at ESMO GI a couple months ago. It's a clear new treatment option for these patients, and that's an important implication also looking at BRAF mutations.
Yeah, you know, nowadays when I talk to the melanoma people, it takes like 15 minutes to go through the whole toxicity issue of BRAF inhibitors alone as opposed to these combinations. And now you're adding an EGFR antibody. What about fever? Because that's been seen with the BRAF MEK. Do you still see that when you add in the...
There are a couple of patients. Occasionally you see that, but that's not a major problem. In the patients I've treated, looking at the data, the fever is not a major problem.
Interesting. The other tissue comment that you made related to this consensus group related to mismatch repair. Can you talk a little bit about what we've learned about that issue and also the types of testing that are available and the type that are recommended?
Yes, until, let's say, last ASCO meeting, MSI testing was recommended in two settings. One, in patients with stage 2 colon cancer, to help us to select which patients would be candidates for an adjuvant treatment. MSI patients, microsatellite instable tumors, these patients had a good prognosis, and even 5-FU in these patients with stage 2, not with stage 3. There are clearly data that adjuvant 5-FU in patients with stage 2 and an MSI tumor that could harm the patient in this situation. So there was a recommendation not to treat patients with an MSI stage 2 tumor. The second situation where MSI testing was done until last ASCO as a first screening test to look whether they were part of a Lynch family, a Lynch syndrome, as a first test before doing the mutation analysis. Since last ASCO, we have now strong data, low number of patients, but strong data that patients with a colon cancer, metastatic disease then, with an MSI tumor, that they may have a dramatic benefit from a checkpoint inhibitor, pembrolizumab. The data were presented for the first time at ASCO, were published in the New England Journal of Medicine shortly after ASCO in June. And what this trial showed, low number of patients again, is that patients with colon cancer with an MSI tumor, that more than 60% of the patients had an objective response, and more than 90% of patients had tumor growth control for a certain period, quite durable, quite long duration. While a colon cancer with an MSS tumor, so microsatellite stable tumor, that these patients had no objective responses. And then the interesting part in this study also was that they treated a small group, and we are talking of 10 to 15 patients in each group, a small group of patients with non-colorectal cancer, MSI, and this included a couple of small bowel or pancreatic tumors, if they were MSI, that they also benefited from treatment with pembrolizumab in this situation. So that are some interesting findings. I don't think we can make strong recommendations today that all colon cancer should be tested for MSI, but the evidence is growing. If this is further confirmed in a bit larger studies, then for these patients with an MSI tumor, metastatic disease, checkpoint inhibitors may be an option in the near future. We have to realize also, and that's also another important piece of information, that of the metastatic colorectal cancer, around maximum 5% of patients are MSI. And there are two ways to test for MSI. That's either immunohistochemistry on the biopsy, either at some molecular test with a PCR. We clearly recommend today, if we would check for that to see whether they are eligible for checkpoint inhibitors, to do a PCR testing, so a molecular testing.
So have you had any patients yourself treated on trial or off trial with a checkpoint inhibitor with MSI?
We have treated a couple of patients with MSI in a nivolumab trial. The analysis of the whole results of the trial is ongoing, but I can tell you that I've seen patients benefiting from the treatment. I can't tell you the global results. The trial is not yet published. And we will start soon, within a couple of weeks, with the pembrolizumab trial also in this situation, in MSI tumors, colon cancer, metastatic colon cancer, of course.
So another issue I'm really curious how your consensus group approached is the issue of second-line therapy in a typical non-resectable metastatic colorectal cancer. And this has been the subject of a lot of debate over the last few years. So as you mentioned, typically now patients are receiving either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI with bevacizumab, and a common scenario is a patient responds and then has gradual disease progression. And at this point, theoretically, I guess you'd have several possible, for example, anti-angiogenic strategies to consider: continuing Bev, aflibercept, and now ramucirumab. How would you compare the data involved in that situation, and did the group put their heads together about what they recommend?
It's not an easy question, and there are indeed some new interesting data, but the first remark is we don't have head-to-head studies of bevacizumab versus aflibercept versus ramucirumab. If you look in cross-trial comparisons, the relative benefit of these different anti-angiogenic strategies is very similar. If we look at the hazard ratio or the benefit in median survival, it's very similar. If you look on the other hand, and this type of reasoning will be in the paper, of course, if you look on the other hand of some of the safety issues and toxicity issues, continuing Bev has, again, cross-trial comparisons as the lowest toxicity. It seems that aflibercept has a bit more toxicity. We didn't discuss so much of ramucirumab at the face-to-face meeting, because ramucirumab, the data were presented for the first time at ASCO GI, and we met just before, a couple of days before ASCO GI, in this situation. But we discussed again afterwards a little bit, and also in the preparation of the manuscript. Ramucirumab is a drug with similar activity, a little bit, seems cross-trial comparisons, a little bit less toxicity than aflibercept. The toxicity numbers just numerically were a bit higher than with bevacizumab, but this may be selection bias also. What is clear is also, and in Europe that plays a role, and we make a statement on that, is that economic factors play a role and that they clearly have implications on recommendations also in this setting. Ramucirumab is not yet available for colon cancer in many countries. In Europe, it's available for gastric cancer, but not yet for colon cancer. So we don't have a strong recommendation about ramucirumab in this situation. What we do recommend further on is that the choice of which anti-angiogenic agent may depend a little bit on the duration of benefit in the first line. And that's, again, indirect data that come from a little bit looking at the inclusion criteria. But a patient with rapid progression on FOLFOX-BEV, for instance, in first line, progression after 2 to 3 months, physician will be willing to change a treatment. You may change to FOLFIRI or aflibercept in these patients, especially if the tumor is RAS mutant, where the anti-GVR antibodies are not an option. While if a patient was on fulfoxibef, 5 months, oxaliplatin was stopped, for instance, because of neurotoxicity. Patient goes on with 5-FU-BEF for another 5 months, and then he has a progression of the disease. There, the proposed strategy is usually to go on with the other cytotoxic FOLFIRI and then continue with BEF in this group of patients. So the patients with a longer time to tumor progression while on BEF may benefit more from then continuing BEF, and there is no need to change BEF to aflibercept in these patients because of the higher toxicity profile of aflibercept. So that's a kind of differentiation, again, coming from, let's say, extrapolations and coming from indirect data, not head-to-head studies of BEF versus aflibercept.
I'm not sure how often this happens, but there are situations where patients receive upfront EGFR antibodies. What do you do in the second-line situation there?
It doesn't happen very often, but it may happen if the strategy was, for instance, to convert the metastasis to become resectable. And if it fails, if the patient doesn't become resectable, then, of course, the cytotoxic partner is stopped. And then the most frequent choice and recommendation is then to go in second line with the other doublet plus BEF and change the anti-GVAR antibody to BEF. That's also based on the ECOG 3200 study, where patients who were BEF naive were then treated in second line with FOLFOX plus or minus BEF, and there was a benefit for adding BEF. So that's the direct evidence for this statement, but there is the other circumstantial evidence from other trials that this is the most frequent recommendation in this situation. Aflibercept, in theory, may be also an option in this group of patients, but there's a bit more toxicity. There is no, let's say, push, no need to put aflibercept up front before BEF in the recommendations.
You mentioned the issue of the patient who needs a response. Either you're trying to convert them to being resectable. There's some situations, maybe the patient's very symptomatic. How strong is the evidence suggesting that an EGFR antibody causes, you know, a higher response rate than, say, an anti-angiogenic like BEV?
We believe in Europe, but not only in Europe, the consensus was global also, including several American experts also and several Asian experts, that in this group of patients, the evidence is there that if you look at the different trials, as well in the CLGB trial, as in the FIRE-3 trial from Germany, where there was a head-to-head comparison of BEF versus cetuximab, in both trials, the response rate, if there was any difference that was there in both trials, then it was the response rate. The response rate with the anti-GVAR antibodies in RAS wild-type patients is higher than with the chemo doublet plus bevacizumab. However, some physicians may choose also in this group of patients where you really need the response. Our Italian colleagues and friends will say in this group of patients, you need a triplet FOLFOXIRI. FOLFOXIRI we don't combine. There's no recommendation to combine that with cetuximab or panitumab. If we combine that with an antibody, it's usually combined with bevacizumab. And that's another belief. There is no evidence from randomized trials in this group of patients where you really, well, to my opinion, whether you really need to give FOLFOXIRI BEV versus a doublet plus an anti-GVAR antibody. Personally, what I do in my practice is I give them usually FOLFOX or FOLFIRI plus cetuximab in order to downsize. I started treatment today, a patient, for instance, a 55-year-old man. The primary tumor that was taken out 6 weeks ago, he recovered well from the operation. He has a RAS and BRAF wild-type tumor, and he has two metastases, one of around 6-7 centimeters in the right lobe, but clearly attached completely to the intrahepatic part of the vena cava. And then one metastasis 2 centimeters more in the left lobe. In this patient, in contrast to what I usually do, in this patient I started him with a doublet plus an anti-GVAR antibody because I explained to him that we really want to shrink the metastasis coming detached from the vena cava, and that's the reason why I gave him a doublet FOLFOX plus cetuximab in this patient.
For that patient, what was your thinking in not using FOLFOXIRI BEV?
Yeah, I do that in pancreatic cancer sometimes, FOLFOXIRI. It's the balance of safety versus activity in this situation. With adding the anti-GVAR antibody to FOLFOXIRI, you increase the response rate. You can say also, of course, with FOLFOX And adding irinotecan so to become FOLFOXIRI, you also increase the response rate. I agree, it's more a belief in this situation. We have evidence for both strategies. You can defend both strategies. Maybe some patients are stronger, but my patients, I'm not a fan of FOLFOXIRI plus BEV in metastatic colon cancer.
So I want to talk a little bit about more advanced colorectal cancer. Once patients have gotten beyond EGFR antibodies, if they're appropriate, and bevacizumab, particularly in the types of situations you think about regorafenib and might be thinking in the future about TAS-102. Can you talk a little bit about, and maybe are there any patients in your practice you want to cite as examples, you know, how you think through approaching these patients?
Well, both treatments are treatments for patients with failing all different treatment options. But an important message is that we should not keep that to the so-called 10th line of treatment in these patients, because if these patients are in very, very advanced stage with poor organ function, poor general condition, the benefit of these agents, the risk benefit, let's call it like that, is not favorable in this situation. So these treatments should be there when patients are really failing the treatment options, third, fourth line, depending how you define a line of treatment in this situation. Regorafenib, clearly, selection of patients is crucial. Good organ function, good general condition, good biochemistry, that's crucial. If patients have already a worse performance status, an ECOG performance status 2, these are not good candidates for regorafenib. These patients are very likely to have more toxicity. So the important message and the learning is also that we should do that in third or fourth line, really after failing, but not in sixth or seventh line after reintroducing again. We think that the benefit is a bit bigger if we do it in a timely way in third or fourth line in this situation. TAS-102 is not yet available. There's no expanded access program running. Of course, I've treated many patients in the trial. TAS-102 is generally well tolerated, and not looking at the biochemistry, it's not easy to tell which patient was on placebo or which patient was on active agent in this situation.
Can you talk about how you approach dosing of regorafenib?
Yeah, at the moment, I start many patients, not all patients, and I must say I've evolved, but I start many patients at the dose of 120 milligrams. 160 milligrams for tablets, 3 weeks out of 4 is the labeled recommended dose. But I do start in my patients, many patients with 120 milligrams. The exception may be a relatively young patient, excellent performance status, Karnofsky of 100%, normal liver function, heavy-weighted patient, there I may start in 160, but in the majority of patients, I start 120. In contrast to some of my US colleagues, I never start with 80 milligrams. If I judge that the patient is not fit enough to start with 120 milligrams, I think we should query whether we should really start, so I don't start with 80 milligrams. And then I follow the patient for 3 weeks. I usually see them back at day 15. We don't see them on a weekly basis, but we give telephone numbers for the patients. And then if they don't have any toxicity at all, neither biochemical, neither clinical toxicity, on 120 milligrams at cycle 2, so day 29, I may go up to 160 milligrams. And that's what I do. And that's possible in some patients. That's not possible in all patients. There are some patients who have slight hand foot syndrome with 120 milligrams, a little bit of diarrhea. Even if they have grade 1, I don't increase the dose. I go on with 120 milligrams in these patients. And this strategy is better. Of course, we don't have evidence from trials, whichever type of trials, that this is the best strategy, but that's the experience. That's what we have learned. There are now some trials who have started now randomizing patients at different doses, and one of them is the 120 milligrams to fine-tune that and to have that also from trials.
What's the time course of the development of side effects with regorafenib, and what specifically do you see?
The time course is, if you look in cycles, it's in the first cycles. The most severe toxicity is seen in cycle 1 and 2. That's logical. So some patients with more severe toxicity will not go until cycle 3 or 4. And then also you may dose reduce that, but it's cycle 1 and 2. And the period that is most difficult is patients running into problems. They start having problems day 10, day 8, day 10 in the first cycle. If nothing is done, the maximum toxicity is around the third week. It further increases at that time period.
And could you talk a little bit more qualitatively about the types of problems you see and also the type of hand-foot syndrome you see clinically? Is it the same as capecitabine, for example?
Now, the hand-foot skin reaction, that's how we call it. There are two definitions amongst dermatologists, that hand-foot skin reaction and hand-foot syndrome. The hand-foot syndrome is the one that we describe when we treat our patients with capecitabine. The hand-foot skin reaction with regorafenib, as well as with other TKIs, the sorafenib that we use in HCC or in renal cell cancer, that's quite similar. That's hand-foot skin reaction, and that's a bit different than the hand-foot syndrome that we see with capecitabine. We see in more severe patients blisters on the hands, on the palms, the foot soles, swelling around that can be quite painful in these patients. We don't see the fissures, but the swelling and the blisters, that's a problem in some patients. The second side effect that we see sometimes with regorafenib is the fatigue and the diarrhea. With under 20 milligrams, it's not severe, grade 3, so-called grade 3 diarrhea, grade 3 fatigue. This was not often the case neither with 160 milligrams, but with 160 milligrams in the trials, it was a combination of the different toxicity. A patient who complained of fatigue, grade 2 fatigue, diarrhea, a little bit anorexia, a little bit nausea, and then the hand-foot skin reaction. So the combination of these different toxicity, that was what was a problem for some patients in this situation. And then there are two other toxicities that are important. That's one, the liver function. It's not frequent, but we see occasionally patients where the bilirubin goes up within cycle 1, at the end of cycle 1 or before starting cycle 2, or even at day 14 in the middle of cycle 1, we see a bilirubin that goes up to 2-3 times the upper limit of normal. We see the transaminases that go up. Of course, if that happens, then we have to stop. There are a couple of cases, it's not frequent, but of severe and fatal liver function abnormalities. And then the last toxicity is, and that's not very frequent either, is a more generalized skin rash, erythema over the whole body. You see that also sometimes with other TKIs, sunitinib, sorafenib. It's not frequent, but it can happen, and a physician should be aware. And we are not so afraid of this type of generalized skin reaction, but it can happen in some patients.
What's your vision in terms of the mechanism of anti-tumor action of regorafenib? A lot of people view it as an anti-angiogenic. Is that your view?
It's probably really targeting multiple pathways. It's not only anti-angiogenic. We see also some activity with regorafenib in the GIST tumors, which is probably not the anti-angiogenic effect. So it's really also growth inhibition, c-KIT, for instance, PDGF, so the platelet-derived factor. There are different targets that are tackled. So it's growth inhibition as well as anti-angiogenic effect in patients.
So you presented at the ESMO GI meeting recently the results from the CONSIGN trial. Can you talk about what that study is and what you saw?
CONSIGN study was a phase 3b study that was led by Axagrote and myself. It was a study, an open label study, 2,800 patients. The study was designed also at the request of the authorities, at least the European authorities, I'm aware of that, that they requested to have more experience, to look better in the safety profile. And therefore, over 2,800 patients were treated with regorafenib, at that moment, the classic label dose of 160 milligrams. We looked at progression-free survival and at toxicity aspects and tried to take off some learnings. We didn't report and record survival in the patients. The progression-free survival was 2.7 months with regorafenib, which was slightly longer than in the correct study, the randomized study. This may be due to the fact that the evaluations had not to be done so strictly at week 8 like in the correct study. If you do the scan at 3 months, you may extend also the PFS. But the good thing was to see that it was 2.7 months in this study. And then we looked at the safety profile, brought up some learning curves. The data were very similar to what we saw in the correct study. And then also then what was seen in the Chinese CONCUR studies. In fact, there are 3 studies in colon cancer with regorafenib. That's the correct study, the CONCUR study, which was an Asian study, randomized placebo versus regorafenib, very similar to the correct study that is well known to everybody. And then the CONSIGN study, which is this 3B study. It's not rocking science, what we did there, but it's rather to collect more data in big clinical practice in this, and with very detailed recording of the safety profile also.
I see that about 15% of the patient had treatment emergent hypertension. Is that what's been seen with the other studies? And what's your experience with hypertension, regorafenib?
Regorafenib can cause hypertension like any other TKI, like sunitinib, axitinib, sorafenib, and so on. Hypertension in this population is not a major problem. You have to follow it to record it. You can treat it with the classic antihypertensive agents, including a calcium blocker, including a beta blocker, or an ACE angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitor with these different agents. You see it indeed in some patients, but in most of the patients, it's what we call a grade 1, 2. It's rather mild hypertension, but it can occur. And of course, if it occurs, patients should be treated with antihypertensive agents. But these patients already were exposed in the past also to bevacizumab, where bevacizumab can also cause hypertension. So there was not a real major problem in this group of patients and in these studies.
When you treat a patient with regorafenib who's, you know, otherwise okay, in your own mind, what's the chance you think they're going to benefit either with a response or stable disease that's, you know, kind of for real, so to speak?
Yeah. The chances of having an objective response according to RECIST criteria is very low. It's below 5%. But we see in some patients minor regressions. If you look at the waterfall plots in the trials, you see some minor regressions. And you see also remarkable, interesting changes that we have reported. And we're looking now more in detail into that, collecting the scans of the patients in the correct study. What we see, for instance, in the lungs, is that you see clearly necrotic changes in the center of the lungs. You see that also with bevacizumab, but according, at least to my impression and experience, a bit more with regorafenib than with bevacizumab. But that may be impression. We are looking into the real numbers into that. What we see on top of that, so regorafenib is not a drug that induces responses. I tell that always to the patients, your tumor will not shrink. But what I tell the patient is when they want to ask some numbers, I tell them 40% of the patients will have a tumor growth control, so the tumor will stop from growing for a certain period, always a limited time, for a certain period, around 40%. And that's what we reported also in the correct study. So 4 out of 10 of the patients will have a tumor stabilization for a certain period of time.
Yeah, actually, the first time I heard about these sort of necrotic central changes when you presented a case earlier this year, which I mean, we could see that. When you see a patient who has that, first of all, when does that typically occur? And is that associated with, you know, response or prolonged treatment stability?
We think that it's associated with prolonged treatment. One of my fellows has been looking and has been measuring densities in the scans to have with Hounsfield units. That's methodology radiologists use to measure densities. So we are putting that in tables and in curves. And at least there is a weak correlation, but there is a correlation that these patients with necrotic changes, that they seem to have a longer benefit in that. We see that occurring quite fast. At the first scan at 2 months, you see already these changes. It continues later on, but you can see it at the first scan. And that's also what we're looking at. We have been looking at that in our patients in Leuven, but now, as I mentioned, we're collecting the scans for patients from different centers, as many scans as possible in the so-called, what we call radio-correct study. So that's looking in the radiological, in the scans of patients involved in the correct study. So there is an independent radiologist who is looking at that without knowing whether patients were on placebo or active to see whether these changes are real and what is the real impact of that.
What do we know about regorafenib earlier in the disease, and what are some of the ongoing questions that are being asked in clinical trials about regorafenib?
There are some ongoing questions with regorafenib, especially looking at, there is an intense effort being made to look at some biomarkers. There are no validated data. There may be one of the subgroups, a kind of angiogenic signature, but that may be correlated to a benefit of regorafenib, but that is further to be worked out, and therefore biopsies of these patients are being collected. In earlier lines, regorafenib in colon cancer, that's a very difficult topic. We did a phase 2 study also with FOLFOX, regorafenib in first line. There was some activity, of course, but these patients were treated with FOLFOX, regorafenib. The activity is not appealing enough to combine regorafenib, as was shown also with the other TKIs, to combine that with a cytotoxic doublet. The balance activity, increased toxicity is not optimal, not good. So that's not the way to go. So it's difficult to put that. You could think of strategies of maintenance with regorafenib, But the field has changed also over the last 2 years with the data from the Dutch Cairo trial, with the data from the Swiss, from the German trials, all relatively small trials, but putting all that together, the best maintenance treatment is a fluoropyrimidine plus bevacizumab after first-line induction treatment with a doublet plus bevacizumab. So if you've then to compare regorafenib in this setting, in this maintenance treatment, with slightly more toxicity in this, that's probably not the way to go. So it's difficult. So at the moment, the clinical place of regorafenib is where it is, and there are no immediate, let's say, data to be expected in early lines.
Let's talk a little bit about TAS-102. First of all, can you explain what it is and how it works?
TAS-102 is a new fluoropyrimidine. So it's a classic cytotoxic. It's a fluoropyrimidine which acts on different enzymes. It has, however, slightly different mechanism of action of 5-FU, which is a TS inhibitor. TAS-102 has some differences in the mechanism of action. And that's why in the initial Japanese studies, it was initially studied in patients failing 5-FU. And that's what we also did in the RECORSE trial that we published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine. Patients failing 5-FU, amongst the other available treatment options, it seems that the benefit was not spectacular, but there was a clear benefit over placebo, even if a patient had its last treatment, a 5-FU-based combination, and even if the patient was refractory to 5-FU. So, and that's reflected by some differences in the mechanism of action with 5-FU.
And what about tolerability issues and side effects?
TAS-102 was well tolerated. The most frequent toxicity was neutropenia. More than 35% of patients had grade 3 and 4 neutropenia. However, less than 5% of patients had neutropenic fever. So neutropenia is clearly there. However, it did not have a single agent a lot of implications in clinical practice. And the other side effects are really very limited, with, of course, a little bit of fatigue, like with any cytotoxic agent, but there is not a lot of diarrhea, no thrombosis, no liver function abnormalities, no nausea and vomiting in these patients. So there is clearly a place for this. With the TAS-102, if you look in the data, what is also relevant for the practicing oncologist is that in the TAS-102 trial, around 20% of these patients were pretreated with regorafenib. 80% were regorafenib naive. Looking in the subgroups, whether a patient was pretreated with regorafenib or not pretreated with regorafenib, the benefit over placebo was very similar.
Any interest in combining TAS-102 with regorafenib?
Interesting, there's work ongoing. Our Japanese colleagues are doing some interesting studies of the combination of TAS-102 plus bevacizumab, have shown that this combination is tolerable, is feasible, as we could expect. There's no overlapping toxicity. However, the combination of TAS-102 plus cytotoxics, that's a bit more difficult topic. There is some work ongoing because of the hematologic toxicity of TAS-102. Hematologic toxicity, if you would combine it with irinotecan or with oxaliplatin, we haven't seen a lot of data that's ongoing. We may have to look also in the scheduling of TAS-102 and to change some aspects in the scheduling. It's a clear recommendation in clinical practice today not yet to combine TAS-102 with irinotecan or oxaliplatin until we have figured out whether really we can combine these drugs. If that's figured out, there may be a place to go up front with TAS-102, or there may be options to go for TAS-102 in combination with bevacizumab in view of the good tolerance in patients, for instance, in early lines as a maintenance treatment, or even in patients not fit enough to go for a combination treatment of two cytotoxics plus a biological plus bevacizumab. These patients also, we may look into the role of TAS-102 plus bevacizumab in early lines. But there are no data, no trials yet, but there are just some ideas that may be explored.
How are you going to decide in terms of sequencing TAS-102 with regorafenib?
There are no objective data to say what is the best sequence in this situation. If we would stick to the classic label dose of the regorafenib under 60 milligrams, then TAS-102 would compare clearly favorable to regorafenib regarding toxicity. If you look at the relative benefit of TAS-102 versus placebo or regorafenib versus placebo, that seems very similar. But now that we are moving towards 120 milligrams of regorafenib. I'm not sure to make any statements, not sure enough to say which one is the best benefit-risk ratio. I don't know, and I think their experience in the future will learn us once we treat more patients outside of clinical trials with TAS-102.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special audio-video CME program on novel agents and emerging strategies in the management of metastatic colorectal cancer.